This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Coldest Girl in Cold Town, written by Holly Black, read by Christine Lakin.
Soundtrack by BookTrack.
Dedication for Steve Berman, who inspired the story that inspired this novel. Chapter 1. Nothing can happen more beautiful than death. Walt Whitman. Tana woke lying in a bathtub. Her legs were drawn up, her cheek pressed against the cold metal of the faucet. A slow drip had soaked the fabric on her shoulder and wetted locks of her hair. The rest of her, including her clothes, was still completely dry, which was kind of a relief. Her neck felt stiff. Her shoulders ached. She looked up dazedly at the ceiling, at the blots of mold grown into Rorschach patterns. For a moment, she felt completely disoriented. Then she scrambled up onto her knees, skin sliding on the enamel, and pushed aside the shower curtain. The sink was piled with plastic cups, beer bottles, and askew hand towels. Bright, buttery, late summer sunlight streamed in from a small window above the toilet, interrupted only by the swinging shadows made by the garland of garlic hung above it. A party. Right. She'd been at a sundown party. Oh, she said, her fingers on the curtain to steady herself, popping 3 rings off the rod with her weight. Her temples throbbed dully. She remembered getting ready, putting on the jangling bracelets that still chimed together when she moved, and the steel-toed oxblood boots that took forever to lace and were mysteriously no longer on her feet. Remembered the way she'd lined her foggy blue eyes in shimmering black and kissed her mirror for luck. Everything got a little blurry after that. Levering herself up, Tana stumbled to the faucet and splashed water on her face. Her makeup was smudged, lipstick smeared across her cheek, mascara spread like a stain. The white baby doll dress she'd borrowed out of her mother's closet was ripped at the sleeve. Her black hair was a tangled mess that finger combing didn't do a lot to fix. She looked like a dissipated mime. The truth was that she was pretty sure she'd passed out in the bathroom while avoiding her ex, Aiden. Before that, there'd been some playing of a drinking game called The Lady or the Tiger, where you bet on whether a tossed coin would come up heads, lady, or tails, tiger. If you picked wrong, you had to do a shot. After that came a lot of dancing and some more swigs from a bottle of whiskey. Aiden had urged Tana to make out with his new sulky-mouthed, strawberry-haired girlfriend, the one who was wearing a dog collar she'd found in the mudroom. He said it would be like an eclipse of the sun and the moon in the sky, a marriage of all things dark and light. "You mean an eclipse of the sun and moon in your pants," Tana had told him. But he'd been doggedly, infuriatingly persistent. And as the whiskey sang through her blood and sweat slicked her skin, a dangerously familiar recklessness filled her. With a face like a wicked cherub, Aiden had always been hard to say no to. Worse, he knew it. Sighing, Tana opened the bathroom door. Not even locked, so people could have been coming in and out all night with her right there, behind the shower curtain, and how humiliating was that? And padded out into the hall. The smell of spilled beer filled the air, along with something else, something metallic and charnel sweet. The television was on in the other room, and she could hear the low voice of a newscaster as she walked toward the kitchen. Lance's parents didn't care about his having sundown parties at their old farmhouse, so he had one almost every weekend, locking the doors at dusk and keeping them barred until dawn. She'd been to plenty, and the mornings were always full of shouting and showers, boiling coffee and trying to hack together breakfast from a couple of eggs and scraps of toast. And long lines for the 2 small bathrooms, with people beating on the doors if you took too long. Everyone needed to pee, take a shower, and change clothes. Surely that would have woken her. But if she had slipped through it, and everyone was already out at a diner, they would be laughing it up, joking about her unconscious in the tub and whatever they'd done in that bathroom while she was asleep. Plus, maybe photos. All kinds of stupid stuff that she'd have to hear repeated over and over when school started. She was just lucky they hadn't markered a mustache on her. If Pauline had been at the party, none of this would have happened. When they got wasted, they usually curled up underneath a dining room table, limbs draped over each other like kittens in a basket, and no boy in the world, not even Aiden, was bold enough to face Pauline's razor tongue. But Pauline was away at drama camp, and Tana had been bored, so she'd gone to the party alone. The kitchen was empty, spilled booze and orange soda pooling on the countertops and being soaked up by a smattering of potato chips. Tana was reaching for the coffee pot when, across the black and white linoleum floor, just on the other side of the doorframe to the living room, she saw a hand, its fingers stretched out as if in sleep. She relaxed. No one was awake yet, that was all. Maybe she was the first one up. Although when she thought back to the sun streaking through the bathroom window, it had seemed high in the sky. The longer she gazed at the hand, though, the more she noticed that it seemed oddly pale, the skin around the fingernails bluish. Tana's heart started to thud, her body reacting before her mind caught up. She slowly set the pot back on the counter and forced herself to cross the kitchen floor, step by careful step, until she was over the threshold of the living room. Then she had to force herself not to scream. The tan carpet was stiff and black with stripes of dried blood, spattered like a Jackson Pollock canvas. The walls were streaked with it, handprints smearing the dingy beige surfaces. And the bodies. Dozens of bodies. People she'd seen every day since kindergarten. People whom she played tag with and cried over and kissed were lying at odd angles, their bodies pale and cold, their eyes staring like rows of dolls in a shop window. The hand near Tana's foot belonged to Imogen, a pretty, plump, pink-haired girl who was planning to go to art school next year. Her lips were slightly apart, and her navy anchor print sundress rode up so that her thighs were visible. She appeared to have been caught as she was trying to crawl away, one arm extended and the other gripping the carpet. Ada's, Elena's, and John's bodies were piled together. They'd just gotten back from summer cheer camp, and it started the party off with a series of backflips in the yard just before sunset, as mosquitoes buzzed through the warm breeze. Now, dried blood crusted on their clothing like rust, tinting their hair, dotting their skin like freckles. Their eyes were locked open, the pupils gone cloudy. She found Lance on a couch, posed with his arms thrown over the shoulders of a girl on one side and a boy on the other, all three of their throats bearing ragged puncture marks, all three of them with beer bottles resting near their hands as if they were still at the party, as though their white-blue lips were likely to say her name at any moment. Tana felt dizzy. The room seemed to spin. She sank to the blood-covered carpet and sat, the pounding in her head growing louder and louder. On the television, someone was spraying orange cleaner on a granite countertop while a grinning child ate jam off a slice of bread. One of the windows was open, she noticed, curtain fluttering. The party must have gotten too warm, everyone sweating in the small house and yearning for the cool breeze just outside. Then, once the window was open, it would have been easy to forget to close it. There was still the garlic, after all, still the holy water on the lentils. Things like this happened in Europe, in places like Belgium, where the streets teemed with vampires and the shops didn't open until after dark. Not here. Not in Tana's town, where there hadn't been a single attack in more than 5 years. And yet it had happened. A window had been left open to the night and a vampire had crawled through. She should get her phone and call. Call someone. Not her father. There was no way he would be able to deal with this. Maybe the police. Or a vampire hunter, like Hemlock from TV. The huge, bald, former wrestler always decked out in leather. He would know what to do. Her little sister had a poster of Hemlock in her locker, right next to the pictures of golden-haired Lucian, her favorite Cold Town vampire. Pearl would be so excited if Hemlock came. She could finally get his autograph. Tana started giggling, which was bad, she knew, and put her hands over her mouth to smother the sound. It wasn't okay to laugh in front of dead people. That was like laughing at a funeral. The unblinking eyes of her friends watched her. On the television, the newscaster was predicting scattered showers later in the week. The NASDAQ was down. Tana remembered all over again that Pauline hadn't been at the party, and she was so fiercely, so selfishly glad that she couldn't even feel bad about it, because Pauline was alive even though everyone else was dead. From far away in the guest room, someone's phone started to ring. It was playing a tinny remix of Tainted Love. After a while, it stopped. Then two phones much closer went off almost at the same time, their rings combining into a chorus of discordant sound. The news turned into a show about three men who lived together in an apartment with a wisecracking skull. The laugh track roared every time the skull spoke. Tana wasn't sure if it was a real show or if she was imagining it. Time slipped by. She gave herself a little lecture. She had to get up off the floor and go into the guest room, where jackets were piled up on the bed, and root around until she found her purse and her boots and her car keys. Her cell phone was there, too. She'd need that if she was going to call someone. She had to do it right then. No more sitting. It occurred to her that there was a phone closer, shoved into the pocket of one of the corpses, or pressed between cold, dead skin and the lace of a bra. But she couldn't bear the idea of searching bodies. Get up, she told herself. Pushing herself to stand, she started picking her way across the floor, trying to ignore the way the carpet crunched under her bare feet, trying not to think about the smell of decay blooming in the room. She remembered something from her sophomore year social studies class. Her teacher had told them about the famous raid in Corpus Christi, when Texas tried to close its cold town and drove tanks into it during the day. Every human inside who might have been infected got shot. Even the mayor's daughter was killed. A lot of sleeping vampires were killed too, rooted out of their hiding places and beheaded or exposed to sunlight. When night fell, the remaining vampires were able to kill the guards at the gate and flee, leaving dozens and dozens of drained and infected people in their wake. Corpus Christi vampires were still a popular target for bounty hunters on television. Every kid had to do a different project for that class. Tana had made a diorama with a shoebox and a lot of red poster paint to represent a news article that she'd cut out of the paper. One about three vampires on the run from Corpus Christi who'd break into a house, kill everyone, and then rest among the corpses until night fell again. Which made her wonder if there could still be a vampire in this house. The vampire who had slaughtered all these people, who'd somehow overlooked her, who'd been too intent on blood and butchery to open every door to every hall closet or bathroom, who hadn't swept aside a shower curtain. It would murder her now, though, if it heard her moving. Her heart raced, thundering against her ribcage, and every beat felt like a punch in the chest. Stupid, her heart said. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Tana felt lightheaded, her breath coming in shallow gasps. She knew she should sit down again and put her head between her legs. That was what you were supposed to do if you were hyperventilating. But if she sat down, she might never get up. She forced herself to inhale deeply instead, letting the air out of her lungs as slowly as she could. She wanted to run out the front, race down the lawn, and pound on one of the neighbors' doors until they let her inside. But without her boots or phone or keys, she'd be in a lot of trouble if no one was home. Lance's parents' farmhouse was out in the country, and all the land behind the house was a state park. There just weren't that many neighbors nearby. And Tana knew that once she walked out the door, no force on earth could make her return. She was torn between the impulse to run and the urge to curl up like a pill bug, close her eyes, tuck her head beneath her arms, and play the game of, since I can't see monsters, monsters can't see me. Neither of those impulses were going to save her. She had to think. Sunlight dappled the living room, filtered through the leaves of trees outside. Late afternoon sun, sure, but still sun. She clung to that. Even if a whole nest of vampires were in the basement, they wouldn't, couldn't come up before nightfall. She should just stick to her plan. go to the guest room and get her boots and cell phone and car keys, then go outside and have the biggest, most awful freakout of her life. She would allow herself to scream or even faint so long as she did it in the car, far from here, with the windows up and the doors locked. Carefully, carefully she pushed off each of her shining metal bracelets, setting them on the rug so they wouldn't jangle when she moved. This time, as she crossed the room, she was aware of every creak of the floorboards, every ragged breath she took. She imagined fanged mouths in the shadows. She imagined cold hands cracking through the kitchen linoleum, fingernails scratching her ankles as she was dragged down into the dark. It seemed like forever before she made it to the door of the spare room and twisted the knob. Then, despite all her best intentions, she gasped. Aiden was tied to the bed. His wrists and ankles were bound to the posts with bungee cords, and there was silver duct tape over his mouth, but he was alive. For a long moment, all she could do was stare at him, the shock of everything coming down over her all at once. Someone had taped garbage bags over the windows, blocking out sunlight. And beside the bed, gagged and in chains, amid the jackets someone had swept to the floor, was another boy. One with hair as black as spilled ink. He looked up at her. His eyes were bright as rubies and just as red. Chapter 2. We all labor against our own cure, for death is the cure of all diseases. Sir Thomas Browne. When Tana was 6, vampires were Muppets, endlessly counting, or cartoon villains in black cloaks with red polyester linings. Kids would dress up like vampires on Halloween, wearing plastic teeth that fitted badly over their own, and smearing their faces with sweet syrup to make mock rivulets of cherry-bright blood. That all changed with Casper Morales. There had been plenty of books and films romanticizing vampires over the last century. It was only a matter of time before a vampire started romanticizing himself. Crazy, romantic Casper decided that unlike decades of ancient, hide-bound vampires, he wouldn't kill his victims. He would seduce them, drink a little blood, and then move on, from city to city. By the time the old vampires caught up with him and ripped him to pieces, he'd already infected hundreds of people. And those new vampires, with no idea how to prevent the spread, infected thousands. The first outbreak happened in Casper's birthplace, the smallish city of Springfield, Massachusetts, around the time Tana turned 7. Springfield was only 50 miles from her house, so it was in the local news before it went national. Initially, it seemed like a journalist's prank. Then there was another outbreak in Chicago, and another in San Francisco, and another in Las Vegas. A girl, caught trying to bite a blackjack dealer, burst into flame as cops dragged her out of a casino to their squad car. A businessman was found holed up in his penthouse apartment, surrounded by gnawed corpses. A child stood at Fisherman's Wharf on a foggy night, reaching up her arms to any adult who offered to help find her father, just before she sank her teeth into their throats. A burlesque dancer introduced blood play into her act and required audience members to sign waivers before attending her performances. When they left hungry. The military put up barricades around the areas of the cities where the infections broke out. That was the way the first cold towns were founded. Vampirism is an American problem, the BBC declared. But the next outbreak was in Hong Kong, then Yokohama, then Marseille, then Brecht, then Liverpool. After that, it spread across Europe like wildfire. At 10, Tana watched her mother sit at her mirrored vanity and get ready to go to the party of an art buyer, intent on lending her gallery a few pieces. She had on a pencil skirt with an emerald-colored silk shell top, her short black hair gelled tightly back. She was fastening on a pair of pearl drop earrings. "Aren't you afraid of the vampires?" Tana had asked, leaning bonelessly against her mother's leg, feeling the scratch of tights against her cheek and inhaling the smell of her mother's perfume. Usually, both of her parents were home before dark. Tana's mother had just laughed. but she came back from the party sick. Cold, they called it, which at first sounded harmless, like the kind of cold that gave you the sniffles and a sore throat. But this was another kind of cold, one where body temperatures dropped, senses spiked, and the craving for blood became almost overwhelming. If one of the people who'd gone cold drank human blood, the infection mutated. It killed the host and then raised them back up again, colder than before. Cold through and through, forever and ever. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there was only one cure. The victim had to be kept from drinking human blood until the infection was flushed out of the system, which could take up to 88 days. No clinic provided such a service. In the beginning, hospitals had heavily sedated cold patients, until a middle-aged and very wealthy woman came out of her medically induced coma to attack a doctor. Some people managed to take the edge off the craving for blood with booze or drugs. Nothing worked for others. But if the police found out about a potential case of infection, that person would be quarantined and relocated to a cold town. Tana's mother was terrified. And so, 2 days in, once the shakes had gotten bad enough and the hunger came on, she agreed to be locked up in the only part of the house that would hold her. Tana remembered the screams rising from the basement a week later. Screams that went on all day long, while her father was at work, and then all through the night, when her father turned up the television until it drowned out every other sound and drank himself to sleep. In the afternoons after school, between bouts of screaming, Tana's mother would call for her, pleading, begging to be let out, promising to be good, explaining that she was better now, that she wasn't sick anymore. "Tana, please, you know I would never hurt you, my beautiful little girl. You know I love you more than anything, more than my own life. Your father, he doesn't understand that I'm better. He doesn't believe me, and I'm frightened of him, Tana. He's going to keep me imprisoned here forever. He'll never let me out. He's always wanted to control me, always been afraid of how independent I was. Please, Tana, please. It's cold down here, and there are things crawling on me in the dark, and you know how much I hate spiders. You're my baby, my sweet baby, my darling, and I need your help. You're scared, but if you let me out, we'll be together forever, Tana. You and me and Pearl. We'll go to the park and eat ice cream and feed the squirrels. We'll dig for worms in the garden. We'll be happy again. You'll get the key, won't you? Get the key. Please get the key. Please, Tana, please. Get the key. Get the key." Tana would sit near the door to the basement with her fingers in her ears, tears and snot running down her face as she cried and cried and cried. And little Pearl would toddle up, crying too. They cried while they ate their cereal, cried while they watched cartoons, and cried themselves to sleep at night, huddled together in Tana's little bed. "Make her stop," Pearl said, but Tana couldn't. And when their father put on chain mesh gloves, the kind chefs use to open oysters, and big work boots to bring their mother food at night, Pearl and Tana cried hardest of all. They were terrified he would get sick too. He explained that only a vampire could infect someone, and that their mother was still human, so she couldn't pass on her sickness. He explained that her craving for blood was not so different from how someone with pica might crave chalk, or potting soil or metal filings. He explained that everything would be fine, so long as Mom didn't get what she wanted, so long as Tana and Pearl acted normal and didn't tell anyone what was wrong with Mom, not their teachers, not their friends, not even their grandparents, who wouldn't understand. He sounded calm, reasonable. Then he walked into the other room and downed half a bottle of Jack Daniels, and the screams went on and on. It took 34 days before Tana broke and promised her mother she'd help her get free. It took 37 days before she managed to steal the ring of keys out of the back pocket of her father's tan Dockers. Once Dad left for work, she unlocked the latches, one by one. The basement smelled damp, like mold and minerals, as she started down the creaking wooden stairs. Her mother had stopped screaming the moment the door opened. Everything was very quiet as Tana descended, the scratch of her shoes on the wood loud in her ears. Her foot hesitated on the last step. Then, something knocked her down. Tana remembered the way it felt, the endless burn of teeth on her skin. Even though they weren't fully changed, the canines had still bit down like twin thorns, or like the pincers of some enormous spider. There had been the soft pressure of a mouth and pain, and there had been another feeling too, as though everything was going out of her in a rush. She'd fought back, screaming and crying, kicking her chubby little kid legs and scrabbling with the nails of her pink child fingers. All that had done was make her mother squeeze her more tightly, make the flesh of her inner arm tear, make her blood jet like pumps from a water gun. That was 7 years ago. The doctors told her father that the memory would fade, like the big, messy scar on her arm. But neither ever did. Chapter 3. Death is the dropping of the flower, that the fruit may swell. Henry Ward Beecher. Aiden's eyes were wide and terrified. He strained against the bungee cords, trying to talk through the tape. Tana couldn't make out the words, but she was pretty sure from the tone that he was begging her to untie him, pleading with her not to leave him. She bet he was regretting the time he'd forgotten her birthday, and also the way he'd dumped her via a direct message on Twitter, and, almost certainly, everything he'd said to her last night. She almost started giggling again, hysteria rising in her throat, but she managed to swallow it down. Sliding a fingernail under the edge of the duct tape, she began to peel it back as gently as she could. Aiden winced, his caramel eyes blinking rapidly. Across the room, the rattle of chains made her stop what she was doing and look up. It was the vampire boy. He was pulling against his collar, shaking his head, and staring at her with great intensity, as though he was trying to communicate something important. He must have been handsome when he was alive, and was handsome still, although made monstrous by his pallor and her awareness of what he was. His mouth looked soft, his cheekbones sharp as blades, and his jaw curved, giving him an off-kilter beauty. His black hair was a mad forest of dirty curls. As she stared, he kicked a leg of the bed with his foot, making the frame groan, and shook his head again. Oh yeah, as if she was going to leave Aiden to die because the pretty vampire didn't want his snack taken away. "Stop it," she said, louder than she'd intended because she was scared. She should climb over the bed, to the windows and pull down the garbage bags. He'd burn up in the sun, blackening and splintering into embers like a dying star. She'd never seen it happen in real life, though, only watched it on the same YouTube videos as everyone else. And the idea of killing something while it was bound and gagged and watching made her feel sick. She wasn't sure she could do it. "Stupid, stupid, stupid," said her heart. Tana turned back to Aiden, her hand shaking now. "Stay quiet, okay?" At his nod, she pulled the tape free from his mouth in one swift rip. "Ow," Aiden said. Then he lunged at her, teeth first. Tana was reaching for the bungee cord, restraining his wrist when it happened. His sudden movement startled her so much that she stumbled back, losing her balance and yelping as she fell onto the pile of jackets. His blunt canines had grazed her arm, not far from where her scar was. Aiden had tried to bite her. Aiden was infected. She'd made a noise loud enough to maybe wake a nest of sleeping vampires. "You asshole," she said, anger the only thing standing between her and staggering panic. Forcing herself up, she punched Aiden in the shoulder as hard as she could. He let out a hiss of pain, then smiled that crooked, sheepish smile that he always fell back on when he was caught doing something bad. "Sorry, I didn't mean to, I've been lying here for hours thinking about blood." She shuddered. The smooth expanse of his neck looked unmarked, but there were lots of other places he could have been bitten. "Please, Tana. Please." She'd never told Aiden about her mother, but he knew. Everyone at school knew. And he'd seen the scar, a jagged mess of raised, shiny skin, pale with a purple cast to the edges. She told him how it felt sometimes, as if there were a sliver of ice wedged in the bone underneath. "If you just gave me a little, then..." Aiden started. "Then you'd die, idiot. You'd become a vampire." She wanted to hit him again, but instead she made herself squat down and root among the jackets until she found her own purse with her keys. "When we get out of this, you are going to grovel like you've never groveled in your life." The vampire boy kicked the bed again, chains rattling. She glanced over at him. He looked at her, then at the door, then back at her. He widened his eyes, grim and impatient. This time she understood. Something was coming. Something that probably heard her fall. She waded through scattered jackets to a dresser and pushed it against the door, hopefully blocking the way in. Cold sweat started between her shoulder blades. Her limbs felt leaden. She wasn't sure how much longer it was going to be before she couldn't go on, before the desire to curl up and hide overtook her. She looked over at the red-eyed boy and wondered if a few hours before he'd been one of the kids drinking beer and dancing and laughing. She didn't remember seeing him, but that didn't mean anything. There'd been some kids she didn't know and probably wouldn't have remembered. Kids from Conway or Meredith. Yesterday, he might have been human. Or maybe he hadn't been human for 100 years. Either way, he was a monster now. Tana picked up a hockey trophy from the dresser. It was heavy in her hand as she crossed the floor to where he was chained, her heart beating like a shutter in a thunderstorm. "I'm going to take off your gag, and if you try to bite me or grab me or anything, I'll hit you with this thing as hard as I can and as many times as I can. Understood?" He nodded, red eyes steady. His wax-white skin was cool to the touch when she brushed his neck to find the knot of the cloth. She'd never been this close to a vampire. Never realized what it would be like to be so near to someone who didn't breathe, who could be still as any statue. His chest neither rose nor fell. Her hands shook. She thought she heard something somewhere in the bowels of the house, a creaking sound, like a door opening. She forced herself to concentrate on unknotting the cloth faster, even though she had to do it one-handed. She wished desperately for a knife, wished she'd been clever enough to pick one up when she'd been in the kitchen. Wish she had something better than a pot metal trophy covered in gold paint. "Look, I'm sorry about before," Aiden called from the bed. "I'm half out of my head, okay? But I won't do it again. I would never hurt you." "You're not exactly someone who's big on resisting temptation," Tana said. He laughed a little, before the laugh turned into a cough. "I'm more the run toward it with open arms type, right? But really, please believe me, I scared myself too. I won't do anything like that again." Infected people got loose from restraints and attacked their families all the time. Those kinds of stories weren't even headline news anymore. But vampires weren't all monsters, scientists kept insisting. Theoretically, with their hunger sated, they are the same people they were before, with the same memories and the same capacity for moral choice. Theoretically. Finally, the knot came apart in Tana's hand. She scuttled back from the red-eyed boy, but he didn't do anything more than spit out the cloth gag. "Through the window," he said. His voice had a faint trace of an accent she couldn't place, one that made her pretty sure he was no local kid infected the night before. "Go. They're swift as shadows. If they come through the door, you won't have time. But you... cover me with a heavy blanket. 2 blankets. And I'll be tucked in tight enough against the sun." Despite looking only a little older than Aiden, the calm command in his voice spoke of long experience. Tana felt momentarily relieved. At least someone seemed to know what to do, even if that someone wasn't her. Even if that someone wasn't human. Now that she was out of his range, she set down the trophy carefully, back on the dresser, back where it belonged, back where it would be found by Lance's parents and... Tana stopped herself, forced herself to focus on the impossible here and now. "What got you chained up?" she asked the vampire. "I fell in with bad company," he said, straight-faced, and for a moment she wasn't sure if he was joking. It rattled her, the idea that he might have a sense of humor. "Be careful," Aiden called from the bed. "You don't know what he might do."
"We all know what you do, though, don't we?"
the vampire accused Aiden in his silky voice. Outside, the sun would be dipping down toward the tree line. She didn't have time to make good decisions. She had to take her chances. There was a comforter on the bed, underneath Aiden, and she started yanking on it. "I'm going for my car," she told both of them. "I'm going to pull up to the window, and then you'll both get in the trunk. I have a tire iron. Hopefully, I can snap the links with that." The vampire looked at her in bewilderment. Then he glanced toward the door, and his expression grew sly.
"If you free me, I could hold them off."
Tana shook her head. Vampires were stronger than people, but not by so much that iron didn't bind them. "I think we're all better off with you chained up, just not here." "Are you sure?" Aiden asked. "Gavriel's still a vampire. He warned me about you and about them. He didn't have to. I'm not going to repay that by..." She hesitated, then frowned. "What did you call him?" "That's his name," Aiden sighed. "Gavriel. The other vampires, while they were tying me to the bed, they said his name." "Oh." With a final tug, she pulled the blanket free and tossed it over to Gavriel. Her heart thundered in her chest, but along with the fear was the reckless thrill of adrenaline. She was going to save them. There was a sudden scrabbling at the door, and the handle began to turn. She shrieked, climbing onto the bed and hopping over Aiden to get to the window. The garbage bag ripped free with one tug, letting in golden late afternoon light. Gavriel gasped in pain, pulling the blanket more tightly around him, turning his body as much behind another dresser as he could. "Lots of sun still," she shouted between breaths. "Better not come in." The movement outside the door stopped. "You can't leave me here," Aiden said, as Tana shoved at the old farmhouse window, swollen by years of rain. It was stuck. Her muscles burned, but she pushed again. With a loud creak, the window slid up a little ways. Enough to get under, she hoped. The cool, sweet-smelling breeze brought the scent of honeysuckle and fresh-mowed grass. Looking over at the lump of comforter and jackets and shadow where Gavriel was hiding, she took a deep breath. "I won't leave you," she told Aiden. "I promise." No one else was going to get killed today. Not if she could save them. Certainly not someone she'd once thought she loved, even if he was a jerk. Not some dead boy full of good advice. And she hoped, not herself, either. Leaning forward, she ducked her head under the window frame, ignoring the splinters of worn gray wood and old paint. She tossed out her purse. Then she tried to shimmy a little, to get the swell of her breasts over the sill, and cant her hips so that she could grab hold of the siding, and pull herself forward enough to drop down headfirst into the bushes. It was a short, bruising fall. For a long moment, the sunlight was too bright and the grass too green. She rolled onto her back and drank in the day. She was safe. Clouds blew across the sky, soft and pulled as cotton candy. They shifted into shapes of mountains, into walled cities, into open mouths with rows and rows of sharp teeth, into arms reaching down from the sky, into flames, and a sudden gust made the branches of the trees shiver, raining down a few bright green leaves. A fly buzzed in the grass near her shoulder, making her think suddenly of the bodies inside, of the way the flies would be landing on them, of the opalescent maggots that would hatch and tunnel, multiplying endlessly, spreading like an infection, until black flies covered the room in a shifting carpet, until all anyone could hear was the whirring of their glassy wings. Tana started to shake like the trees, her limbs trembling, and was overcome by such a wave of nausea that she was barely able to twist onto her knees before she was sick in the grass. "You said that you were allowed to lose it," some part of her reminded herself. "Not yet. Not yet," she told herself, although the very fact that she was renegotiating bargains with her own brain suggested things had already gotten pretty bad. Forcing herself up, Tana tried to remember where her car was parked. She walked across the sloping lawn, toward a line of cars, and then past each, touching the hoods, feeling as if she was going to vomit again every time she noticed stuff inside. Books, sweaters, beads hanging off rearview mirrors, the small tokens of people's lives, the things they would never see again. Finally, she got to her own Crown Vic, opened the door with a creak and slid inside, drinking in the faint, familiar smell of gasoline and oil. She'd bought it for a grand the day she turned 17 and sprayed its scrapes with a can of lime green Rust-Oleum, making it look more like a vandalized cop car than anything else. She and her dad had rebuilt the engine together during one of the few periods when he came out of his fog of misery long enough to remember he had two daughters. It was big and solid, and it drank gas with an unquenchable thirst. When she slammed the door shut, for the first time since she walked out of the bathroom, maybe for the first time since she arrived at the party, she felt in control. She wondered how long it would be before even that slipped through her fingers. Chapter 4. Why fear death? It is the most beautiful adventure in life. Charles Frohman. Tana's secret, the secret she never told anyone, was that she had a recurring dream. Sometimes months passed without her having it. Sometimes she had it night after night for a week. In the dream, she and her mother were together, undead, dressed in billowy white gowns with ruffles at their collars and at the hems of their skirts. They ran through the night together in a darkling fairy tale of blood and forests and snow, of girls with raven's wing hair and rose-red lips and sharp teeth as white as milk. The way they became infected was slightly different each time, but usually it went like this. Tana was the one who went cold first. The details of that part were always elided. The hows and whos of the attack never asked or answered. The dream usually began with her father dragging her to the basement door and telling her he would never let her out again. Never, ever, ever. Tana might howl and weep and plead in an orgy of grief. She might shower him with tears, but his heart was hard as stone. Eventually, he got tired of her weeping and pushed her down the stairs. She hit her head against the wood slats and grabbed for the railing to break her fall. But although her nails scrabbled at it, she couldn't catch hold. She wound up at the bottom with her breath knocked out of her. There she sat, on the cold floor of the basement, as spiders crept over her hands and beetles clacked, as mice padded from the shadows to squeak and steal strands of her hair for their nests, as she listened to her mother argue for her release and her sister cry. But every time her mother called her father cruel, he put another lock on the door, until there were 30 brass locks with 30 brass keys. Day after day, he had to open each lock to leave Tana a bowl of water and a bowl of porridge on the very top step. Then he had to lock her up all over again. Finally, Tana learned the music of the locks and crept up the stairs just as the keys began to turn. There she waited for him. He had been careful, but not careful enough. When the door opened, she sprang up and bit him. They would tumble down the stairs together in a blur, and when she woke, she was a vampire, and her father was unconscious beside her. Then her mother came down and hugged Tana in her soft arms and told her that everything would be okay. They were going to leave very soon, but first, Tana had to bite her mother. Her mother would be very insistent, saying that she couldn't bear to worry about Tana out in the world alone and that she wanted to be with her always. Sometimes Tana's mother would even beg, "Please, Tana, please." Tana always bit her. When Tana was younger in her dreams, blood tasted like fizzy strawberry soda or sherbet. If you drank it too fast, you got brain freeze. When she was older, after she'd licked a cut on her finger, the taste of that became the taste in her dreams. Copper and tears. After Tana's mother was infected, she bit Tana's father while he was unconscious, because she needed human blood to complete her own transformation. And biting him was fine because you couldn't go cold from being bitten by infected people. After that, they would put him to bed. He was probably tired. He slept peacefully while Tana and her mother told Pearl that they would be back for her when she was older. Then they put on long gowns and went out into the night, mother vampire and child vampire, to hunt and haunt the streets together. They'd be the good kind, like the devoted scientists who'd infected themselves to study the disease better, like the vampire bounty hunters who hunted other vampires, like the vampire woman in Greece who still lived with her husband, making all his meals at night and leaving them for him to reheat while she slept the day away in a grave of freshly turned earth under the root cellar. Tana and her mother would be like that, and they would never kill anybody, not even by accident. In the dream, everything was convenient. Everything was perfect. Everything would be fine forever. In the dream, Tana's mother loved her more than anyone or anything, more than death. "I don't want to be a vampire," she told herself over and over again. But in her dreams, she kind of did. Chapter 5. He whom the gods love dies young. Menander. Driving across Lance's lawn, Tana ran over a coiled length of hose and crushed the daffodil patch that his mother had planted. Then she threw the Crown Vic into reverse and pulled up to the window as tightly as she could. As soon as her bumper hit the wall, she got out, climbed on top of the car, and tried to wriggle back through the window, this time holding a tire iron. It took several tries and a lot of jumping and scrambling and kicking. When she did make it in, her calves and hands scraped, she realized that the room was darker than it had been. The shadows were lengthening as afternoon turned inexorably toward evening. It was probably after 6 already, maybe after 7. The smell of death hung heavy in the air. "Tana," Aiden said as soon as he saw her. "Tana, they're going to come in as soon as it's dark. They told us." He looked pale and frantic, worse than she remembered him looking when she'd left. "We're going to die, Tana."
"Komda ni amor,"
a voice rasped from the other side of the door. She could hear the creatures whispering to one another in the hall, shifting hungrily, waiting for the sun to set. Her hands shook. She whirled on Gavriel, who was watching her with those eerie garnet eyes, huddled in the corner like a black crow. "What does that mean?"
"There are so many odd, dappled patches of sunlight here," he called to them from his pile of blankets and jackets, ignoring her. "Come in. I long to watch your skin blister. I long to..."
"Don't say that!" she cut him off, panicked. If the vampires pushed their way in, she had no idea what she would do. Run, probably. Abandon them. Aiden pulled against his bonds. "They keep talking to him in a whole bunch of languages. A lot of French. Something about the Thorn of Istra. I think he's in trouble." "Are you?" Tana asked.
"Not exactly," said Gavriel.
Tana shuddered and looked back toward the window and her car with longing. The Thorn of Istra? She'd once seen a late-night special called Piercing the Veil, Vampire Secrets from Before the World Went Cold. On screen, two guys in tweed jackets talked about their research into how vampires had stayed hidden for so long. Apparently, in the old days, a few ancient vampires held sway over big swaths of territory, like creepy warlords, with more vampires who were basically their servants. Vampires took victims who wouldn't be missed, killing after every feeding. But if a mistake was made and a victim survived long enough to drink blood, it was a thorn's job to hunt down that newly turned vampire and to kill anyone it bit during its short, savage life. Being a thorn for one of the old vampires seemed to be half a punishment and half an honor. On the program, the Tweedy men had chuckled over how desperate those thorns must have been once Casper Morales started his world tour, all of them scrambling to put down an infection that had already spread out of control. The Thorn of Istra had, apparently, been driven mad by it. The special showed a grainy video of a meeting beneath the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. And while elegantly dressed vampires conducted business around him, the Thorn had been in a locked cage, his face and body streaked with blood, laughing. He'd laughed even harder when they found the videographer and dragged him up to the cage, howling wildly just before he bit out the man's throat. She'd seen the expressions on the pale faces of the other vampires. He'd frightened even them. "The Thorn of Istra's hunting you?" Tana asked. The thought of the thorn out of his cage was chilling. But that's no problem. Gabriel was silent. Maybe she should leave him. Untie Aiden and get the hell out of there. Even if it meant leaving one chained-up vampire to fend off however many were on the other side of the door. Even if it was unfair. She took a deep breath. Last chance. Are you in need of rescuing? His expression turned very strange, almost as if she'd struck him. Yes, he said finally. Maybe it was that nearly everyone else was dead and she felt a little bit dead too. But she figured that even a vampire deserved to be saved. Maybe she ought to leave him, but she wasn't going to. She walked over to Gabriel, her face tracing the configuration of his heavy chains. One was looped around the foot of the bed frame. His wrists had been manacled together in front of him with thick iron cuffs. Those chains linked to the ones attached to another pair of cuffs, these on his ankles. The easiest way to free him would be to lift the bed, something he could probably have done if his arms weren't restrained, but she wasn't sure she could do it. She was certain she couldn't do it with Aiden still lying on the mattress, weighing the whole thing down. "Do you think you can keep from biting me?" she asked him. Aiden was silent for a long moment. "I don't know." Well, at least he was being honest. She grabbed Gabriel's gag from a heap of things on the floor and climbed onto the edge of the bed. "You're not so far gone yet. Try," she told him. Bending down, she tied the cloth around Aiden's mouth as quickly as she could, double knotting it on the back of his head so that it would take a while to work free. At least she hoped it would. He stayed still and let her. When she was done with the gag, she started unhooking the bungee cords restraining his legs. That went fast, at least. There were no knots. It did involve climbing over him in the bed, and despite the fact that he was cold, despite the fact that they were in danger, Aiden still managed to cock an eyebrow at her. She was about to say something quelling when, on his left ankle, she found twin puncture marks with slight bruising around them, the blood itself taking on a bluish tone. She inhaled sharply, but didn't say anything. Didn't touch them. They seemed horribly private. Then, because there was no way around it, she untied Aiden's arms. He sat up, pushed himself back against the headboard and rubbed at his wrists. His chestnut hair hung in his face, tousled, as if he'd just woken up. "Get them in the car," she told herself. "Lock them in the trunk, get away, and figure out everything else from there." "If you try to take off the gag, I'll hit you with this tire iron," she warned him, fetching it from the floor and waving it in what she hoped was a menacing way. Since Aiden couldn't talk, he made a sound that Tana hoped was agreement. "Okay, now you're going to help me detach Gabriel's chains from the bed," she said. Aiden shook his head vigorously. "We don't have time to argue," she told him. His shoulders lowered and he sighed through his nose. She gave him a long look, and then he moved reluctantly to brace his hands against the footboard. Tana knelt down so that when Aiden lifted the bed, she managed to pull the heavy chain free. She scooted out and Aiden let go. The frame crashed back down, shaking the floorboards. The vampire shifted, links pulling, the whole rattling thing making an eerie sound that reminded Tana of medieval dungeons on late-night movies. He lifted his arms, his cuffs still attached. Aiden tried to say something, but the words were muffled by the gag. Tana guessed that what he had to say was sarcastic. "There's a roll of the garbage bags that were taped up on the windows," she said, poking around the floor at the collection of things the vampires had abandoned. "Maybe if we wrap some of those around you, then even if the blanket slips, you won't burn. We can duct tape it together, as long as you don't mind looking ridiculous." The vampire smiled a closed-mouth smile. Tana passed the black bags and the tape to Aiden. Squatting down in the shadows, Aiden began half-assing together some makeshift plastic armor for Gabriel. It looked as silly as Tana had promised even before the blankets. "If I'm hurt," Gabriel said as Aiden worked, "you must be very careful." "We'll be careful," she told him. "Don't worry."
"No, Tana, you must listen," he said. "You must be careful of me."
It was the first time he'd used her name, and the sound of it in his mouth, said with his odd accent, made it unfamiliar. "We won't let you get burned," she said, turning away to open handbags and stick her fingers into the pockets of jackets, hoping against hope that one of her friends carried a knife. Even though you're a vampire and you probably deserve it. I'm sorry, she said to each of the dead as she unzipped and unfastened their things. I'm sorry, Courtney. I'm sorry, Marcus. I'm sorry, Rachel. I'm sorry, John. I'm sorry I'm alive and you're dead. I'm sorry I was asleep. I'm sorry I didn't save you and now I'm taking your things. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There were no knives or stakes. The only things she found were a length of cord with several religious symbols from around the world knotted on it, including a large evil eye that glittered with crystals and a small stoppered bottle of rose water with a piece of thorn-covered vine floating in it. Tana could use all the protection she could get. She took the water and the cord, stuffing them into her purse. Then she picked up Rachel Meltzer's cell phone. She dialed 911 and chucked it onto the bed. Outside the door, a floorboard creaked.
Little mouse, a voice said through the keyhole. Don't you know the more you wriggle, the greater the cat's delight?
Aiden made a soft whining sound behind his gag. Tana felt a wave of terror roll over her. It was an all-consuming animal fear, vast and incomprehensible. There were things that could think and talk, and they still wanted to kill her and eat her. For a long moment, she couldn't move. Then, pushing through the weight of her terror, she looked toward the window, where the first orange streaks of sunset were turning the trees to gold. The dark was coming. We have to go, she told Aiden. He wasn't as done with covering Gabriel as she would have liked, but they'd run out of time. She lifted the tire iron and swung it at the window, smashing the pane and the wood rails and stiles. Glass fell around her in a shimmering pile. We're going now, she yelled. Now! Aiden, come on! Get Gabriel over here! The operator was calling from the phone on the bed, her tinny voice sounding very far away. What is your emergency? Hello, this is 911. What is your emergency? Vampires! Tana shouted, throwing down her boots and tossing the tire iron after them. Aiden helped Gabriel up, wrenching him to his feet. He was wrapped like some modern mummy, shining strips of duct tape holding together garbage bags and blankets, lurching toward the window. Tana had no idea if it was enough to keep him from being burned, but it would have to do. Already she was trembling with the urge to abandon all plans and just escape, slither out onto the lawn and run. Aiden, you go out the window first, Tana said, cutting off her own train of thought, shoving down her fear. Someone's got to be down there to take Gabriel's feet. Aiden nodded and swung his leg over the sill. He looked back at her for a moment as though trying to decide. Then he jumped, landing badly on the roof of the Crown Vic. Behind Tana, there was the sound of splintering wood, as though something very large had hit the door. No, she said softly. Oh, no. No. Leave me, said Gabriel. Something struck the door again, and the dresser fell over, crashing against the bed. Forcing herself not to turn, she pushed the rat body against the window. Shut up, or I might, she told him. Now sit, swing your legs over and drop. He shifted his body, and Tana braced herself to act as a counterweight and to keep him from falling before he was in position. Aiden stood under the window, catching his feet. Taking a deep breath and hoping the duct tape and blanket shroud would hold, she let him go. Aiden eased Gabriel onto the top of the trunk. The door of the room cracked open behind her. Keep going, she told herself. Don't look back. But she looked anyway. Two creatures stood framed by the doorway, one male and the other female. Their faces were puffy and pink, bloated from all the blood they'd consumed. Their mouths and sharp teeth were ruddy, their eyes sunken, clothes stiff and stained dark. They weren't the slick vampires from television. They were nightmares, and they were coming at her, wading through the jackets, flinching from waning pools of light. Tana scrambled for the windowsill, her body shaking, her hands trembling so ferociously that she almost couldn't get a grip on the wood frame. Going up on her knees, she threw herself forward, missing the car entirely and falling onto the lawn. Fingers clamped down on her calf, pulling her back. She kicked hard, dragging herself forward with her arms. Teeth scraped against the back of her knee just as she pulled free and toppled away from the window. Behind her, there was a high, keening